House Committee on the Judiciary, Wednesday, May 2nd, 2001, 5 p.m., Hearing Room 357.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Committee on Judiciary, full committee. We have, if you look, you'll see that we've got a somewhat abbreviated agenda from what was originally posted because a number of those bills have not moved out of the subcommittee to the full committee. But we do have a number of bills to discuss. In the interest of allowing Mr. Taylor to go back to work, we're going to hear House Bill 3446, which is at the bottom of the agenda, which is the only bill which he's carrying on today's agenda.
The last shall be first, Mr. Chair, right?
And the last shall be first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3446 comes to you from Representative Devlin, requires the Department of Corrections of the Oregon State Hospital to conduct a study of feasibility of establishing a sex offender treatment pilot program with an adult male corrections facility that would, one, identify those offenders most likely to benefit from treatment, and two, provide treatment alternatives in residential treatment settings for a period of 18 to 24 months. We heard this bill the other day. Representative Walker is the carrier of the bill. And the fiscal impact statement is doesn't seem like it's significant. Doesn't tell us much and doesn't seem to cost any money.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other day, council was just yesterday. Though it seems like forever. We did not have any testimony in opposition. The only person to testify was, well, he called himself a doctor. Gary Field, administrator, well, you called him doctor, Mr. Chair, but it doesn't say the doctor on here. He's the administrator of the counseling and treatment services of the Oregon Department of Corrections.
He's a doctor.
And, he is today. I'm frankly, I was actually shocked to learn that the state of Oregon Department of Corrections does not have a sex offender treatment program in the facility. In any of our prison systems. They closed a program at the Oregon State Hospital 6 years ago, and they have a pre-release treatment program, had one up until 4 years ago, and mostly, all they do at this point is when a sex offender is released into the community, then they begin treatment programs. This bill started out as requiring that they do establish sex offender treatment pilot program, and now it's just a study to see how effective those programs would be. Frankly, colleagues, I was shocked because not only am I concerned about preparing these inmates for reentry into society, but I was also quite concerned about in protecting inmates in the facility who are not sex offenders and who could be preyed upon by those who are being ignored in the treatment system, which I think creates all kinds of problems that I'll be looking into in the future. But I think this is a good bill to give us some ideas. Part of the problem, as testified by Dr. Field, is the studies out there, they're not very clear. It's amazing to me that here we are in the year 2001 and there's not enough empirical evidence out there about what programs work and which ones don't. So that's what this study will hopefully help us learn. And I would urge your support.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Is there any questions for Representative Walker about the bill? We adopted the -2 amendments in subcommittee. Anybody here to comment on this? Okay. Representative Walker, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 3446 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Walker moves House Bill 3446 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? If you'll call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
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 Representative Jerry. Excuse.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. the regulations. The bill receives the necessary votes. It'll move to the floor with a due pass. Representative Kiwaka, will you carry?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Arguably the free top consumer to the state, and we did just, I just came from a hearing on prescription drug costs, but public hearing of the bill, health and human services, and
Okay, we're going to go back up to the top of the agenda then, and we're going to start with a work session on Senate Bill 69. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 59.
Senate Bill.
Senate Bill, thank you. Senate Bill 69. Deals with interpreters in juvenile dependency and delinquency proceedings for parents or others granted the right of limited participation.
Okay.
And Representative Lowe is the carrier. It had a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement was issued.
Representative Lowe.
This is one of the access to justice issues.
Yes.
When a child stands before the court in what is the functional equivalent of the trial, that's the adjudicatory stage, the parents are not technically parties to the action. And therefore, as under the language of Oregon law, as it exists presently, they're not entitled to the services of an interpreter. Yet it is at the conclusion of such a hearing that critical issues important to the child are decided, like where they're going to stay in the pretrial phase, or and what terms and conditions of release may be. Oftentimes, the parents do not speak English, and they must rely on the child to interpret for them what the child's terms and conditions of release are. Or while the child is awaiting further proceedings in the adjudicatory phase. This doesn't work well, and so we need interpreters. In addition, it's important to have interpreters when aunts, uncles, grandparents, or guardians may be the ultimate caregivers down the road, and so if they need services, interpretive services, then they should be allowed to have them. This bill will allow that to take place. I would point out to the committee that one of the largest segments of growth, according to the census data, is non-English speaking people in our state, or bilingual people too. Good bill should pass. Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Senate Bill 69 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Lowe. Are there questions by the committee about the bill or for Representative Lowe? Is there anyone here following this bill today? Oh, there they are.
The usual suspects.
Are there any questions of the usual suspects about this bill? I noticed that the bill has minimal fiscal impact, so there was no fiscal statement issued on the bill, which sort of surprises me. Sometimes these interpreter bills end up costing a whole lot of money, so I guess I'm a little surprised by that.
Let's not ask for any.
But I'm not going to ask any more questions. So, anybody else have anything they want to add? Okay, Representative Lowe has a motion pending in front of the committee.
We'll call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Ringel.
Aye.
Representative Ringel.
Aye.
Representative Wilson. Aye. Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Aye. Chair
Williams.
Aye. Representative
Ringel,
did you say aye?
No, I don't.
I'm not sure she can record a here vote as a yes or a no, so. Okay, all right. Good. You and the mouse in your pocket. Okay. All right. We will assign that bill as it passed to the floor, and Representative Lowe, if you so carry.
I'd be honored.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of companion bills.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 75.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 75 is also being carried by Representative Lowe, and this is somewhat related. It's actually not one of the access bills, but it deals with the Citizen Review Board and the Oregon Youth Authority and establishing agreements dealing with placement, substitute placement of youth within the system, and that arrangement had a sunset clause, and this would eliminate that.
Representative Lowe.
This still really extends the sunset. That's what the deal is on this one. Pardon? Oh, eliminates the sunset that has been cumbersome. Thank you. And because it's working well and we need it, the Citizens Review Board really is a good opportunity for the community to participate and assist in the fashioning of our remedial measures for children. The problem is that somebody who is employed by the OIA or a private agency that's regulated by or certified or directed by OIA, those folks really ought not to serve on the Citizen Review Boards because it's kind of a conflict, actually. So that's what Nancy Miller's ABLE amendment does to this, and the bill does pass. Mr. Chairman, I suggest move. I'm tired. That Senate Bill 75 be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. A and gross.
Thank you, Representative Lowe. She's moved Senate Bill 75 as amended A and gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions for Representative Lowe? Did OYA weigh in at the committee on the amendments? Nancy, you want to come up? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good evening. I'm Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. We worked with OIA to write this bill, and they did not testify at the subcommittee, and they did not testify in the Senate. They support the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Nancy about this bill while we have her here? Okay, thank you. Committee, anything? All right, Representative Lowe's motion is pending. If you'll call the roll, Shannon.
Representative
Bassett.
Aye.
Representative
Ringo.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Williams. Aye. Senate Bill 75A and gross moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Lowe, you're on the list for all these. I don't want to listen to you on the floor talk about every one of these bills all in a row. So I'd like to divide it up, not because I don't think you can do it, but it just seems like it's a whole bunch of stuff at once.
I bore the heck out of myself sometimes. So
it's just good to sort of break these things up so people hear a different voice as they're
okay.
All rolling out at the same time.
Chair William, you
yes?
thought perhaps maybe some of these could go to the consent calendar. We haven't got to those yet. But that's okay.
I really don't like the consent calendar.
I know, but considering that we're about 40 bills behind right now, we might just want to consider it.
Well,
suggestion.
Okay, but not this one.
No, not this one. Not this one. No, I didn't mean this one. There's some coming up.
Do I have a volunteer on this bill? Representative Wilson, will you carry this one? All right.
I'll take one.
Way to be a team player. All right.
I'll take one for the team.
All right. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 76.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Senate Bill 76A is another one of the Judicial Department's Access to Justice Committee bills. Representative Lowe is also the carrier on this. And It deals with the Oregon Evidence Code and interpreters and some other housekeeping matters.
Representative Lowe.
I think I'm going to animate my voice for this.
You're
going
to
be left bored.
All right.
This wonderful bill, whenever you have a witness who doesn't speak English or needs an interpreter for sign language because of communication difficulties, you need to have one. And every darn time you have one, they got to be sworn in and qualified according to the court's satisfaction. This bill changes that if they've got a certification under the rules 45.288 and EDSEC, then you don't have to swear them and qualify them each and every time they interpret. But if they don't, then you do.
Representative Shadow.
I think that the owner.
Excellent. I thought it was very well done. Okay. Any questions for Representative Wall? Representative Ringo.
So, you know, I'm not saying that that the notion behind that particular amendment is bad. But I do think that because this is a for any kind of compromise.
It's done in different ways according to different judges. If you want to know the absolute truth, I've had interpreters do. Casual passersby.
And as we speak, a certain educated person on this subject is approaching the witness table, and she shall identify herself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Rhodes, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. I work with Kingsley Click on the interpreter certification program. To become certified, an interpreter goes through a lot, and we passed out a flyer on the program in the subcommittee meeting. If an interpreter is not certified, the point is that they do have to come up and put their qualifications on the record. This might include what their education level is, how long they, what their exposure to both languages is, their education level in both languages. Have they taken any interpreting classes? Have they taken any translation courses? It can involve a lot. We're looking to increase the professionalism of the group.
Representative Ringo.
If the judge is satisfied that the interpreter appears competent, is that sufficient for the judge to go ahead and allow the interpreter to proceed?
The statute, it's in Chapter 45, Chair Williams, Representative Ringo. In Chapter 45, the statute says the judge has to appoint a certified interpreter first. This is one who's gone through all that testing. And otherwise has to appoint an interpreter who the judge determines as qualified. So it is going to vary from judge to judge. It becomes an issue of the judge having discretion over who's interpreting to preserve the record in the courtroom.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who administers the oath to witnesses frequently in my job, I just have one question. It states in here that they must submit qualifications on the record, but do they also sign something in the record that's akin to an oath that they will interpret to the best of their ability?
Yes, Chair Williams, Representative Walker. If the interpreter is not certified, they still have to make an oath on the record that they will interpret to the best of their ability. Part of the certification program, the very last step after all the testing, after court observation, is that they are sworn in by a circuit court judge and sign a written oath, which is on our office, in our office.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, Kathy, we thank you for coming forward and answering these questions. Anybody else? Okay. And Representative Lowe has... Did you move this, Representative Lowe?
I have.
Not yet. Okay. Any other questions about this bill?
So I really speak in a monotone?
No, I'm
but, just checking.
Just fine. Representative Lowe.
Mr. Chairman, I move A.M. Grows 76. Is that what we're on? Yes. To the floor with a due pass.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 76, A.M. Gross, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? Okay, if you'll call the roll.
Okay.
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringhoff?
Aye.
Federley?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye. Work session on Senate Bill 09.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Lowe?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 76, A.M. Gross, moves to the floor. And Representative Lowe, would you like this one, or would you like to share this with somebody else?
Let's share.
All right. Do I have another call in here? Representative Krieger, although you shouldn't get it for the weak eye you gave the bill, I'm having to assign...
That's better than I'm here, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We ought to have somebody who speaks a foreign language carry this bill and have it interpreted for them as they carry it.
That's a great idea.
Isn't that
who's
fine?
Okay. Who speaks foreign
language? Just pig.
I speak German. Anybody else?
No.
Really?
You don't want to hear this in Japanese.
I'm disappointed.
Nice idea.
Representative Krieger shall carry the bill. He speaks Southern Oregonian. Okay. We are now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 77. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 77 also comes from the Access to Justice Committee, and it deals also with the Certified Interpreter Program. Representative Lowe.
Second verse, same as the first. This allows for an interpreter in grand jury proceedings when it is necessary for the proper examination of a witness. That's about it. VAs agree.
Are there any questions for Representative Lowe about this bill? So this again does the same thing, except it's in grand jury proceedings, and it allows someone who is not a certified but a qualified interpreter, if the circuit court determines that a certified interpreter is not available. So it's essentially the same thing, except it's grand jury proceedings.
It's the same thing as the juvenile bill, but
well, it also changes. Right now, district attorneys have to go and get a court order each time that they need an interpreter, and now if you have a certified interpreter, you don't need, under this bill, if you have a certified interpreter, you don't have to go get a court order signed each time you have, for example, a Spanish interpreter in grand jury.
I would also point out to you on page 1 of the A.M. Gross bill at line 21, 22, and 23, the sentence, an interpreter designated under this subsection may be present in the grand jury room and attend the sittings of the grand jury. This is language of art imported from other grand jury statutes, but what is intended there is will attend the sittings of the grand jury when needed as an interpreter. This does not open the door to, you know, sitting around having coffee with the grand jurors.
Okay, that's helpful. Is there any other comments or questions about this bill? Is there any questions for our certified interpreter witnesses in the audience? Okay. Representative Lowe?
Mr. Chair, I move the engrossed version of Senate Bill 77 to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 77, A engrossed, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? If not, call the roll.
Representative
Backlund?
Aye.
Representative
Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringhoff?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
For the record, my name is Paul Swine, and Department of Environmental Quality Cleanup Administrator.
No promotion.
Mr. Chair, this is one I thought might go on the consent calendar.
I believe it has been a year and a half trying to figure out the
what's the committee's,
approach
sense
to funding
about
this,
whether or not this bill ought to go on the consent calendar.
Program. Everyone has worked
talks this about grand jury proceedings, talks
mechanism.
About interpreters. I don't know. What do you
I'll
think?
I'll make my remarks
yes,
very brief.
Actually, I think that perhaps this bill should not go on the consent calendar for the point that there was in it. We'll make it at the very end, make clear in the history of this.
Some liability.
The sitting is limited to the it was so called we covered that in the settlement now in the fall, and I would just soon have that on the floor if anybody ever looks at that.
Okay, so for that very purpose, I shall assign Representative Laurel to be the carrier of this bill.
He might have his mouth.
Wouldn't be a problem, except that we do have 10 vacuum effects on the waiting list right now that I've been cleaned up because the revenue is not available.
Well, I wasn't even at this meeting.
Get on the waiting list and don't get cleaned up.
Well, these were two different meetings, and she just kept volunteering both times.
Lonnie!
We're going to open a work session now on Senate Bill 132.
By having these effects on the waiting list.
Council.
Problems with
Senate Bill 122, we just heard this morning, so hopefully it's familiar to the members of the civil stuff, and it deals with the issue of custodial property and custodians as opposed to trustees, increasing the age from 21 to 25 for transfer to custodians, and also increasing the amount from $10,000 to $30,000. That does not have to be considered by a court. And Representative Lowe was the carrier on
this.
The testimony was presented very ably by the guy that's in charge of the Chris Fine. He did a wonderful job.
There's no mechanism, but we have removed the mechanism.
She pretty much did it all. So
seems like a good idea because kids are now taking much longer than to the age of 21 to get out of college, and we don't want to see overgrowth of red sports cars on the road and non-graduated.
There is some sort of adjustment mechanism in the bill that would get us closer to $1 million.
Nothing personal, kids.
This is a committee. If you'll note, this is at the request of the state planning section of the Oregon State Bar. So this is one of their bar bills that came through their law improvement process in the bar. Are there any questions for Representative Lowe about the bill?
I have one.
Yes, Representative Dingfeld.
How 25 was decided as an age that would be a more responsible age?
Because generally by then the child is out of college. Trust fund kids or kids are better able to handle their finances, that kind of thing. You don't have to automatically extend it to 25. You can do it up to 25. It's certainly, you can set up a trust or transfer property to a minor according to the dictates of the testator or whoever's setting it up, but this allows a little bit more flexibility.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Maybe a comment more than a question.
Chairman,
we have a bill tomorrow that we're going to make 18-year-olds legislators. We're moving it down to make law. Could be sitting here,
and here we're moving it up the other way.
Well, I think the response might be Representative Krieger. The difference is here that this is essentially a situation where you're setting up a trust, and so you're making some determination
for the child and the grandchild about when you think that person's going to be of an age that you want them to have access to those resources. And while we might let some 18-year-olds be legislators, I don't think we're willing to let all of them be legislators. And I agree. And so I guess my question, Representative Lowe, is was there a discussion about the rule against perpetuities in the committee?
No, but I thought about it.
Mr. Olson, want to come up and lead the committee in a discussion on the rule against perpetuities?
No.
Yeah, okay. All right, just checking. Okay, well.
Can you recite it 5 times fast?
We have the bill in front of us, Senate Bill 122. It did not have any amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 122 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 122 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay,
is there any discussion?
Okay, back to 134.
Sir, okay, why don't we call the roll, Shannon?
Aye.
Aye.
Seeing their package for today, there could be a Class 4 amendment.
Aye.
And which is a new amendment for the committee. And also it asks 20.
Aye.
So now we're up to that.
Aye.
On 134.
Senate Bill 122 moves to the floor. Representative Shelley, would you carry this bill?
Please do.
Okay.
I'll just take you out of here the next one, too.
Okay. Senate Bill 123, recession.
Just wanted to make sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 123 also comes from the Oregon State Bar and deals with.
By various accountants, lawyers.
Sorry. It deals with, it revises the statutes dealing with.
But, this allows a little bit more flexibility.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Maybe a comment more than a question in that. If we have a bill tomorrow that we're going to make 18-year-old legislators, we're moving it down to make law, could be sitting here, and here we're moving it up the other way. I don't have any consistency with that train of thought.
Well, I think the response might be Representative Krieger. The difference is here that this is essentially a situation where you're setting up a trust, and so you're making some determination
for the child or the grandchild about when you think that person's going to be of an age that you want them to have access to those resources. And while we might let some 18-year-olds be legislators, I don't think we're willing to let all of them be legislators.
I have one I'd like to extend that to 35. To
yeah, right. And I agree. And so I guess my question, Representative Lowe, is was there a discussion about the rule against perpetuities in the committee?
No, but I thought about it.
Mr. Olson, want to come up and lead the committee in a discussion on the rule against perpetuities?
No.
Yeah, okay. All right, just checking. Okay, well.
Can you recite it five times fast?
We have the bill in front of us, Senate Bill 122. It did not have any amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 122 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 122 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any? Okay, why don't we call the roll, Shannon?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Peters?
Vice Chair
Lowe?
Aye.
Chair
Williams? Aye. Senate Bill 122 moves to the floor with a due pass. Representative Shetterly, would you carry this bill?
Please do.
Okay.
I'll take out of care the next one, too.
Okay, Senate Bill 123, recession.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 123 also comes from the Oregon State Bar and deals with. It deals with. It revises the statutes dealing with non-testamentary trusts and instruments and disclaimers of transfers by will. And it's a consolidation of current law into a single statute. Representative Lowe to carry.
Mr. Chairman, this upgrades to more uniform status such disclaimers. The refusal to accept a testamentary gift is a good tax planning tool, often allowing people to skip generations and pass property intact with less tax consequences to succeeding generations. It's funny you should have asked the question about the rule against perpetuities, because actually that may apply. If you try to stretch this out too far. The disclaimer acts presently are lodged in two different situses in the Oregon statutes, and this is going to tidy them up and put them together. The situses depend upon the nature of the corpus, the nature of the gift. This new proposed legislation consolidates the law and also disconnects some confusing language that were traps for the unwary practitioner in confusing state requirements with federal requirements, so it's tidier and a little more user-friendly. Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass Senate Bill 123 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lowell moves Senate Bill 123A for due pass recommendation. That motion is pending. I guess question for Representative Shetterly. Did you attend this hearing?
I did, at least the latter part of it.
Okay. Did we have a good discussion about this?
Yeah, I think that probably the most salient point in this was that we have, apart from bringing together the disclaimer statutes, was that we have provisions in the Oregon statute that appear to be but are not in fact congruent with federal law, tax law, when it comes to getting the intended tax benefits of a disclaimer, of a qualified disclaimer. This brings us more directly in conformity with federal tax code in terms of what is needed to establish a qualified disclaimer for tax purposes.
I would have loved to attend the Senate hearing on this bill.
If you wonder.
Yeah, it does. Okay. Well, we have the motion in front of us. Is there any discussion? All right, call the roll, please.
Representative
Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Pinkholder?
Aye.
Representative Eichholz?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 123A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, I think I'll give those to you in a package.
That's wonderful.
You're our resident trust. I mean, a man who pushed through the pet trust bill should only have that awesome responsibility.
The estate planning lawyer.
Yeah, we're going to...
Are we done?
We're going to... we are going to skip Senate Bill 220A right now, so we're not going to go into work session on that bill. We are going to go to Senate Bill 597 for a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 597 involves when you go for a test drive in an automobile and just clarifies that it is the driver's insurance as opposed to the dealer's insurance that is that covers you. And Representative Backlund is the carrier.
Thank you, Andrea. We had one person testify this morning, although he had a companion, a 5.5-year-old, who was also at the testimony table. This had no objections, and basically, I think he started with the premise that drivers cause wrecks. And the insurance of those drivers should be the ones who are primarily responsible when there is a wreck. And Andrea covered the essence of the bill. And with that, I think it's pretty much of a, I hate to use the word slam dunk, having watched the Trailblazers suffer. But anyway, it should be relatively.
Okay, thank you, Representative Backlund. Are there questions for Representative Backlund? Representative Shetterly?
Well, not a question, but I think just a comment, just something for us to keep in mind. Next time I have a really bad bill, I'm going to borrow a cute 5-year-old and bring him to the table and call him my son. Dare the committee to have at me.
You must be very careful about that. When he was asked what his daddy did, he said he plays golf.
Yeah. Daddy does at work.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, well, great. We've got Senate Bill 597 in front of us. Representative Backlund, do you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 597 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Backlund moves Senate Bill 597 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? You call the roll.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Dean Fuller?
excused.
Representative Wingo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Mr. Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Aye. Senate Bill 597 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Backlund, Mr. Carey.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
What are you guys laughing at over there? Okay. We'll now go to a work session on House Bill 3787. That will be our last work session of the evening.
Make it last.
Thank you, Chair Williams. House Bill 3787, as you might recall, is the bill having to do with impoundment of vehicles. This bill would require a city over 400,000 to comply with certain requirements regarding the release of impounded vehicles. Significant among those is that any administrative fee charge must be sufficient to cover the actual administrative cost for impoundment.
Thank you. Representative Ackerman was assigned to carry this bill to the committee. He transmitted a note to me this afternoon saying something hit him up and he needed to return to district, so he is not with us this evening. And I'm not necessarily prepared to take everyone through a long discussion of this. Just suffice it to say that this was a bill that had some initial contention in it between primarily the car rental agencies and the city of Portland as to how the system was working with respect to people who had rented vehicles and then were apprehended engaging in some activity that under normal circumstances would require that vehicle either be forfeited or impounded. They spent considerable time working on this problem and came to an agreement in the Dash 3 amendments, which you have in front of you, which substantially address the issues. Of course, because of the passage of Ballot Measure 3, the city of Portland had essentially stopped its forfeiture operations on those crimes anyway as a result of that. But this, I think, makes the things clear that need to be made clear. The one point that I think we needed to make on the record was that nothing in this bill would change the right of the city to maintain possession of a vehicle needed for crime scene evidentiary purposes. So in other words, if there had been some activity in the vehicle and it was needed as the evidence of a crime, that impoundment would be allowed to continue. And that this would not change that current relationship as it applies. So that's probably what you need to understand about the bill and the amendments, and I think the parties are here, but unless they feel the need to come forward and say anything, we'll move. I think we adopted Dash 3, so the chair would move House Bill 3787 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Shannon, if you call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Aye. Aye. House Bill 3787 as amended moves to the floor with a pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman was assigned to carry it here. Would you let him carry it on the floor? Representative Wilson, is this one you might want to carry? All right, why don't I assign it to you then? Okay, with that committee, I think we are done with the business. We should have, because we've kept up on this, a fairly short committee meeting on Friday morning, as I understand it. So you may have a little free time a little later Friday morning, if all goes according to plan. We're adjourned.
Okay, I should get a start, huh?
As Mr. McGee mentioned, a technical adjustment to this budget is requested to remove $2.1 million in other fund limitations for the portion of the JJCOP that was not backfilled by general funds, therefore leaving the budget on page 61 at $17 million in general funds and $18.9 million in total funds.
Sure. Senator Crowe?
Are those reductions manageable reductions?
Dear Senator Crowe, yes, they are, although over the past 4 years, we have also made reductions in services and supplies within administration.
So there will be a squeeze, but it's still manageable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, there will be some things that we don't do, but there will be other areas where we have created efficiencies.
Senator Brennan, do you wish to be recognized?
I think I got my question answered.
All right.
Okay. If there are no more questions on administration, let's move to our capital budget, and that's on page 62. I'd like to talk about two pieces of capital budgeting. And that is, first, we strive to maintain the assets that we have. And secondly, I do want to talk a little bit about our long-term capital construction plan. As Ms. Rizzo mentioned in her overview, we have a dichotomy. We have new regional facilities and a couple of youth accountability camps, which were built after 1995 and are in excellent condition. We also have McLaren and Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility, and Fort Worth Study Camp, which were built prior to 1995. As a matter of fact, between the years 1923 and 1979. And those on page 64 discuss our asset protection. And we have two basic areas that I'd like to talk about. The first is we have an asset maintenance program, and this was assisted in the last couple of years by the purchase and implementation of automated software, which is operational at all facilities except for our work-study camps. This assures that we know which items need to be reviewed and that we review those timely so that we continue the value in the properties and also protect our use of the facilities for programmatic reasons. The second asset protection emphasis that the agency has is in 1998, we contracted with a consultant to do a facilities condition survey of our older facilities. The consultant identified over $7 million in necessary improvements to current assets to be done over a period of years. Using the consultant's input and also our own assessment of our properties, we've constructed a six-year capital management plan, which begins on page 65 and goes through page 67. On page 65, you see the budget plan that is created within our six-year capital management plan. The first thing that we do is designate about $400,000 of our base budget services and supplies and facilities for what we call asset protection projects. These are small projects that we do to hold the value of the asset. They're things that if we tap now, will cost us less in replacing them or replacing them later. The second thing that we have is a small capital improvement budget of about $600,000. We use that for somewhat larger items, but once again, most of the work that is done is concentrated at the older facilities where more deterioration has taken place. So in total, we have about $900,000 to spend in 2001-2003 on asset protection and capital improvement. On page 68, you can see that of the capital improvement funding we have, $206,000 is general funds. The remainder is other funds. And at this point, that's a limitation for which there is no guaranteed revenue.
So, Senator Crowe,
what is your anticipation of the revenue going for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, at this time, we have no plans for how we will generate that revenue.
The other funds are...
The other funds are...
So there's no other fund source out there. So, and this is in the budget?
Mr. Chair, Senator Till, yes it is.
What does DAS think about it?
Mr. Chair, at the time the governor's budget was prepared, the agency was discussing the possibility of selling some property on the McLaren site. The time in said that that was still a likely source of that revenue. We have not addressed the issue of whether they will at some point be able to sell that property, or nor has the governor chosen to redirect any general fund in the revised budget.
But it remains in the budget. They're just unidentified other funds that are going to possibly be sold.
At this time, it remains in the budget. WA2 will be able to sell the property in the future.
Mr. Chair, in my closing remarks on asset protection, I'd like to say, as with many state agencies that own property, there are numerous needs in this budget addressed only a small portion of those. It does allow us to address critical items that we have on our list. And in some cases, some of these items may not be done if other emergencies develop and we have to divert funding to those emergencies to continue the operation of our program. The next piece of capital that I'd like to talk about is capital construction. And I'm going to start on page 69. And while there is no funding in the budget for capital construction, there are two types of future needs that I want to mention. And the first one of these is tied to the bed forecast. If you remember, Karen Brazil talked about that our budget is based on a forecast, not by the Office of Economic Analysis, of the operational capacity that we need in some custody facilities for use. And the government's recommended budget was based on the October 2000 forecast, and we now have the May 2001 forecast. While this shows what's occurring in 2001, that forecast is done for 10 years. So that we can see going out what our capital construction needs are, and because there's about a 15-month lead time for any new construction, we need to be projecting where our needs will occur. I've got a chart here of capital construction, and I've also got a piece for each of the answers. What you're getting is an exact replica of this chart. I just want to point out where we are now and where we will be going with the April forecast, and then how that prepares for the government's recommended budget. Currently, we've got 1,181 physical beds that we can use. On July 1st, we'll lose 32 of those beds, which is used in Multnomah County. So on July 1st, that's going to leave us at a capacity 1,149 beds. That's basically this line if you extended it all the way across. That includes accountability camps, work study camps, and unused correctional facilities. If you look at the April forecast, you see that there's growth that goes above the 1149 line. And our first point, and an option that we haven't done yet, to reduce capital needs, would be to remodel key space at HILSA new correctional facilities in South Hall. And the remodeling of that space will give us an additional 50 beds for $1 million. That would then bring, at this point, our capacity to $1,199. And if we were to extend that across, we'd have enough capacity until sometime into the 2003 to 2005 biennium. Now, these, now there's new 25 beds, 175 a day here, as we go out to close to 20 cents. This construction plan is based on the way the agency was set up when it built this regional facility. A regional facility can be built with room to expand. We can add 7 units to the properties that we have at our regional facilities. And they are designed so that we would add 25 bed pods. Facilities, all the basic structures of the regional facilities there, we would just be able to add a pod, add another pod, and each pod would cost $1.4 million. So once we get Scott Hall remodeled, this is going to be capital construction. And we will continue to build our choice to build after using the facilities as well as we plan when we design them. They're all designed, they're designed to change, they're about 6,000 square feet, sort of like adding another module on what we already have. Now, if you look at the governor's recommended budget, we're well below the capacity that we currently have. And even by the end of this biennium, we don't reach our current capacity. However, sometimes as biennium, we start growing that capacity that would be necessary probably to do the Scott Hall remodel. And based on subsequent forecasts by the Office of Economic Analysis, we may need to start planning that remodel sometime later in the biennium. This is the way that we plan for capital construction. It is the way that our newer facilities were built to allow expansion fairly cheaply. And we also have an opportunity to get a good bang for the buck by remodeling Scott Hall into a dorm style factory and giving us capacity for 50 years.
Question, Senator Trull?
A couple of questions. The 150 bed reduction is the bed you're renting in Multnomah County?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Trull, we're actually leasing 32 beds in Multnomah County.
Okay.
We give up that lease. That drops our physical capacity down to 1,149 beds.
Okay.
When we talk about 150 bed reduction, we're talking about the program funding for that, but we still have the facility. So we will still have a facility for 50 years in Tillamook, facilities for 50 years in Riverbend, and space for 50 years.
We're just going to have empty beds because we're not putting people in them. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hill, we would have excess capacity based on the number of youth that we were funded to serve.
The people will be turned away from those beds because we can't afford to put people in and need to do.
Chair, Senator Hill,
and what's happening to those people who are turned away?
Mr. Chair, what we're theorizing is some of those youth will remain in the communities being managed by the local juvenile department. Some of them will continue to be committed to the youth authority and they will come to us for shorter periods of stay, kind of the revolving door effect. Others may be given harsher sentences so that they're guaranteed a longer stay. We don't really, it's hard to guess what local judges and district attorneys will do, but that's what we're imagining.
Senator Burns?
Yes, thanks. John, would you agree with me that the governor's funding level, that the net of beds, that the net impact of it is a cap on the number of kids that we're saving through the Oregon Youth Authority?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, absolutely it is a cap. I mean, we have a cap today. Just that the cap that exists today has been adequate to meet the needs. In that very few counties have struggled to stay under the cap. With 150 bed reduction, clearly counties will struggle to manage within it.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Could you also agree with me that our failed juvenile policies of the 80s were the result of the cap that we had in McLaren and that we did not have beds available for youth that either needed them or deserved them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, in the public testimony that went on prior to you joining the committee, that was pretty clear. And anybody in juvenile corrections always says what makes a difference is the threat of going.
Representative Hanson?
Yeah, I've got two questions. As I understand the six-year maintenance plan, in the next 2 years, you've got $400,000, but you've got about $1 million that you really see as urgent needs that you'd like to adjust in the next 2 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we have $400,000 within our facility services and supplies. We have an additional general fund amount in capital improvements of $206,000 and then other fund limitation which we don't have revenue for. So we have about $600,000 of actual money.
What I'm looking at on your six-year plan, there appears to be quite a few items that are somewhat relate to energy usage, HVAC systems, window replacements. Has this list been reevaluated in light of the increased energy costs that we're going to be looking at?
Senator Miller, Representative Hanson, we've not evaluated each of these with the Department of Energy, but we will do so.
I'm wondering, one, if there's a potential for
to, in essence, bias the board or encourage the board to use its reserve policy to avoid engaging the deficit provisions of the statute such that we would be, if at all possible, to the extent possible, I think is the language, we would try to have a positive balance for the program at the end of its life. That was our understanding of your policy objective. So if that is the case, you've communicated that very clearly.
Does that make sense to everyone? We've talked about this issue, and now that we have a tier one that is going to end at some point in time, whether it be 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, we know that sooner or later the last employee who's on tier one is no longer going to be with us, and at that point in time, tier one ceases to exist, and we no longer have a need for a game loss reserve because we don't have an 8% guarantee anymore. Am I articulating this correctly? And the issue, I think, is that if we direct the board to maintain a positive balance at the end of this tier one, it's direction for what to do with that fund when it's end, because they currently have no direction of where that fund will end up. And we certainly don't want it to be in a negative position.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, my board has asked me to reiterate that the reserve policy is one of the things that can affect the outcome that you seek. But the investment environment is the other powerful factor driving that. So my board asked me to make sure that the committee understood that the board could be very aggressive in using its reserve policy and exactly in alignment with the objectives that you lay out in statute and still not succeed because the environment militated against us. That and the deficits that could emerge in the program won't necessarily show up all of a sudden at the end. It's more that they'll develop in process.
Well, I think
if they were to at all.
Yeah, let's hope they don't. So that's what we're trying to avoid here. I think that the fact that we do have an end in sight for the Tier 1, and then there goes away the need for the game officer, makes the contingency fund all that more important to start working on now, so we then have another, because once that goes away, we don't need that. We still need to have some sort of a contingency in the program, and I think that's my desire now, is to start a directive here to focus the board that the contingency reserve is an important thing, and we need to start funding that now, and maybe we don't need it for 40 years, but when we do need it, it will be there, and I think that's where I am, is from the committee Charles and I are with it. Yeah, you guys always stand right behind me. I get that all the time. Well, I think we've pretty much gone. The only other thing we haven't talked about, I think. Miss, would you have a clear direction of where we want you to go? When you go down to, I think Dave's still here. He's taking notes back to that crazy. So he knows where I want to go, I guess.
Would you like to see language that you want to pick a number, 5%, and go with that? The first 5% of earnings go into the contingency fund, and then probably language to make it absolutely clear that money goes in there, but it stays for the purpose of the entity that generated it. In other words, the employee money is still an employee contingency, and employer earnings are in their proper slot, and so on.
Well, that's,
I think the objective is to avoid having, well, put it in the simplest possible terms, having employee earnings subsidize or otherwise bail out employer costs. That's kind of where we started.
And that's we have to do that or we lose our federal tax status, right?
The advice that I've gotten from DOJ is that is a potential problem because it confronts, and we have a representative from DOJ here today too, if you'd like to speak to him, Mr. Chairman, that goes against the exclusive benefit provision. I would say that
if employee money helps employers,
if the assets of the trust fund were used in a manner that was not for the exclusive benefit of the members, and I would like to caution that there are two ways to try to address this issue. One is to try to segment the gain loss reserve into two different parts and then ask the board to try to divine whether this is an employee contingency the contingency reserve or an employer contingency. That term of art, by the way, has not been, that's a new term of art. I can't, if you were to ask me what it means, I'm not sure I could tell you. An employee contingency versus an employer contingency. The other way to try to address this issue is to try to create a set of uses that are not about employers or about employees, that are about the fund as a whole. So judgments against the fund, legal expenses of the fund, are concepts that conceivably have nothing to do with employers or employees. They are about the fund, and therefore I would defer to my colleague from DOJ, but there's a greater opportunity that those would pass legal muster because they're about the fund and not about individual participants in the fund. And with respect to mandatory funding, the only cautionary note I would put on the table for your consideration is that if we don't have legal uses for the money in the contingency fund, and by legal I mean either statutory ones that you give us or ones that you give us that don't get thrown out by the courts, but we have a mandatory funding provision, we could end up with a big pile of money and no way to spend it. So from an administration of the plan point of view, I would caution you that it's the uses that really allow the board, that both provide the justification of the board to put money in the first place, and also to get it out. The key is the uses.
Well, and that's where the concern of mine is that somewhere back 25, 30 years ago, a legislature saw the need for a contingency fund and set one up, but the board hasn't used it. And that becomes the problem. And that's why if we don't, in my mind, I guess, put some sort of a mandatory thing on there, then the fund will continue to be not used, and then you're going to find yourself in more lawsuits because the groups are going to say, well, look, you had an opportunity to fund something for contingency and you didn't do it. And so it seems to me we have to give you some direction as to, number one, fund it, and number two, then, what are you going to use it for? And that's why some of the things that I outlined were, you know, legislative changes. Obviously, that can have huge impacts on the fund. So it seems odd that we can increase benefits, but we can never reduce them. and that would seem to me that right there, you should have a
because we know we're going to meet here every other year and maybe more often, and every time that happens, this fund becomes more at risk, it seems like, because the benefits can only go one way.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to argue your policy objectives for sure. I guess I would only clarify that, if I could, that I believe the board has not funded the reserve in the past, not because it arbitrarily chose not to exercise the discretionary power that the statute and the legislature has given it, but that the allowable use for the reserve was construed to be very narrow, and therefore to put money in and having no way to get it out didn't seem like a good idea. And I, as I say, I'm speculating because I can't get into the minds of past boards since 1978, but to the extent you have two options in exercising your judgment about pushing the board to put money into the reserve. One is you can expand the uses and present those expanded uses to the board and say, we have just given you additional reasons to put money into the reserve. You're no longer constrained by the old statute that just gave one use that may not apply to modern times but may have applied in 1946. The other option is to say we're going to give you those uses and we're going to give you mandatory funding requirements. And those mandatory funding requirements could be a percentage of annual earnings, it could be a fixed dollar amount, it could be a target percentage of the fund. But if you give us mandatory funding but no uses that we end up with after the statute passes and is reviewed by the courts, we could end up with mandatory funding. It's a one-way street. Money only goes into the contingency reserve and never can get back out. That's the only cautionary note I put on the table.
This is government. If there's money, they'll be fine to where to use it. Okay. Any ideas for uses? And I think that's the key. We need to come up with a list of what we see are uses, and then anything else, but we can't use the word unforeseen. I mean, do our legal minds back there, have you?
That confirmed, Mr. Chairman.
Our legal minds, have you come up with a list of potential uses for this contingency reserve? I thought your legal counsel bailed out on you. I guess he just moved seats.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Muir from the Department of Justice. Again, the Department of Justice, and I personally take no position concerning these amendments or the bill itself. The contingency reserve can be used for anything that benefits. In fact, it can be renamed, reused, and reorganized, so long as the reserve is used ultimately for the benefit of the beneficiaries. And if the committee is interested in assuring that the contingency reserve achieves its broadest possible use for dealing with contingencies in whatever form they may arise, then we would recommend that you use that you substitute for the existing language in the Act broader language that simply says any contingency, which makes it unlikely to there will be insufficient funds to pay the retirement benefits when due.
Okay. If this is a concern I have, if we give say any contingency such as, and we give a list of 5 or 6 or 4 or 5 or 10 things, at some point in time, then is the court going to say, well, look, they had some things, so if anything is not on that list, is then not allowed? Is it better? And I understand you can't make an opinion, but in your opinion, that legal opinion, is it better to just say any contingency benefiting or any contingency that is relevant to the fund, I think, or to the trust, you said, or is it better to lay out a laundry list and say, and give it some uses?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's more than one objective, and let me make my understanding of the objective express and then answer your question. One of your objectives, I think, is to make sure that the reserve is used, and narrow language limits its use, and so it's better to not use lists. The problem with lists is sometimes we get into disputes about whether the list is restrictive or only illustrative, as you were just pointing out, and sometimes the court will say, well, no, the legislature did not mean anything but those particular reasons that the legislature enumerated. With careful drafting, we can avoid that, but it poses more risk than to say any contingency. But there's another issue here, which I think is implicit in particularly the chair's questions, and that is, will the board actually do something with this contingency reserve? And I think you can put language in the act that directs the board and within time limits to identify areas of contingency and to fund those contingencies as identified. But one thing is objectionable. There are two things that are objectionable that I've heard in the discussion. One is to require funds to go in before an objective is defined, because to do that is in effect to divert some part of the income stream to a reserve for which no purpose exists, and then the argument will be you're just tying up pension money which would otherwise go to beneficiaries, and there's no purpose. So there should be a relationship between the funding and the purpose. And when you have fixed amounts like 5% of the income and you don't have the purpose being actuarially determined, like what is the risk, for instance, of an insolvency of an employer, one purpose we've talked about in the past, the argument would be made you're just diverting part of the fund, but there's really no need for it. Let me just stop at that point and see if there are any questions that we can go on. There's some other issues.
Well, the unforeseen circumstances looking better and better.
Well, but what's the unforeseen is no longer unforeseen.
With affirmative obligations on the part of the board to identify the risk and within a period of time to state goals and to start funding. But those are all those points are consistent with the trust duty as it currently exists.
Well, Dave, you've listened to this, and I think you understand what my objective is, and I think that, you know, it seems like Bob has made a good point that, you know, if we can identify some potential uses and direct the board to actuarially fund those uses to be, you know, keep it broad, I guess is what I'm saying. We want this contingency fund to be funded, and we want there to be, you know, so we don't want to make it so narrow so that there are no uses for it, and we don't want it so broad that it's going to get thrown out in court. And I know that's the billion-dollar question you face every time you attempt to write PERS language, but that's my objective.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. This won't be the first time that I've drafted legislation in PERS where I know almost I'm certain it's going to end up in court, no matter what you say. But I thought that some of the things that Bob Muir was saying here with respect to identifying it and then funding it, I think that's one of the things that would be most helpful in being able to defend the funding decision for the contingency fund. If you do have a fixed amount going in, and I have to tell you that's what Bob and I were confabbing about back there just before you called him up, then you're going to have the trouble. If it's just a fixed amount, you're saying, hey, you're going to put 5% in, but you haven't really had some determination of need made by the actuary that says, well, you really need this much. At that point, then the question will be raised by those who don't like that idea as to, you know, well, why are you putting the money in there? Can you really say that that's needed? Or are you just diverting it for the purposes of not putting it into the accounts of the members? And so I kind of like that idea, and I kind of like the idea, too, of what Bob just said about perhaps directing the board to identify those liabilities and those contingencies and leaving some more flexible language with respect to what those contingencies may be. Now, Bob has identified, or the material issue have, I should say, identified some possible uses that they may very well look at. And so that all makes sense to me. But the real question, I guess, for the committee is do you want to go the route of the guaranteed, you know, the mandatory 5% shift? Because if you go that way, then I think you have to think harder about how you're going to draft it as far as to justify that sort of fixed amount going in every time.
Go ahead.
Page 23 was to define simplicity. And then we want money to flow into the fund for those purposes at some kind of a rate, 5%. But then we respond to the idea that, well, if we don't ever have to use them for those contingencies, even though they were stated, that the funds can continue to grow and whatever. Is there some way then to say, you have to let the money flow in for these purposes, but at this rate? But once you get so much money in there, you don't have to do that anymore? Some kind of a cap?
Questions?
You guys can't answer it. I know.
Yeah, the guy in the back.
Well, yeah, I think you could have a mechanism to say it goes in at a given rate until you fund it to the extent that's been identified by the board as necessary to fund it. And then at that point, I think you'd have to say it stops unless there's some additional liability that accrues as time goes on, so you need to put in more money because of new members, growing membership, or things, you may have to add additional amounts. So you could do that. You could say, you could make some direction with respect to funding that initially, but then you'd have to stop at some point once you've got to the figure where the actuary said, really, you don't need more than that. I mean, once you go beyond that, you're into the area of, well, why are you putting money in this reserve?
So that's maybe what we need to look at, is a guaranteed amount up to an actuarially sound amount to fund the contingency that
that'll work, I think. And that would get you past that problem of the guaranteed amount always going in. And you would still need to address the question, does it go to the contingency first, or does it go to the gain loss first? I don't know if you had a resolution on that.
I think that's a decision that has to be made on this side of the aisle, quite frankly. I mean, unless there is a legal reason that it has to go to one or the other first.
I don't think, and frankly, from the effect on employer contributions, it makes little or no difference, frankly.
Mr. Chair, there's no administrative reason why it has to come first or second, except to the extent that there are other requirements in the statute, like the 8% guarantee to Tier 1 members, that have to be funded one way or another, regardless of what that year's funding of the contingency reserve is.
The current language for the contingency fund talks about a deficit of funds, I think. Is that the exact word? If you left that language in as one of the purposes of the contingency fund, along with other identified funds, and then for some reason there wasn't enough money in the gain loss reserve to pay the 8%, wouldn't that automatically trigger a draw in the contingency fund since there's insufficient funds there?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putnam, again, the key to any reserve is the definitions of its uses. And if the uses, you know, said that any actuarial shortfall in the fund anywhere would have a draw on the reserve, then it's conceivable that there could be any of a wide variety of draws, including potentially zeroing out the deficit reserve.
Well, so one of the uses of the contingency reserve could be to offset the gain loss, any deficits in the gain loss reserve.
It could be, except that I would defer to my colleague from DOJ and your legislative counsel. Keep in mind that the statute is very explicit about how a deficit in the deficit account, which is a separate from the contingency reserve, gets zeroed out. And so there's a very explicit mechanism for that, unless the statute made it clear that it was that mechanism as well as funds in the contingency reserve. There should be two parallel treatments. They have to be somehow combined or either kept separate. The contingency, the deficit reserve part of the statute says that in those years in which there are excess returns above the assumed rate, that deficit has the first call on those excess for Tier 1 portion of the earnings until it is satisfied, and then and only then can you consider granting any of the excess to member and employer accounts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your question was, as I understood it, with the existing language, which refers to a deficit in the contingency reserve, does that, would that permit the use of the contingency reserve to pay for a deficit in the existing language, which a deficit in the guarantee reserve, the reserve that guarantees the 8%? No. And the reason is the legislature has already said how the guarantee reserve is to be funded. You draw from it when it's in deficit. You pay back the deficit first out of earnings. Members don't get that money. After their 8%, they don't get any of it. Goes into that reserve that funds it up for 5 years. And after that, there's a call on employers. That's the existing mechanism. And so the general language concerning deficit and the contingency reserve would not address that. And I have to, at this point, speak about a broader issue that is present throughout portions of the Dash 16 amendments. It is our opinion that the use of the contingency reserve or any reserve in the fund to pay for unfunded liabilities of the employer is a diversion of a trust fund to the benefit of non-trust beneficiaries. You cannot... The statute clearly says, and it's consistent with IRS requirements, that the employers pay the unfunded liability. They pay the liability of the system after the employee contribution. So if liabilities accrue to employers, we cannot take interest from the corpus and use that to pay off those liabilities. The trust is impressed not only on the contributions that are made, but on the interest that accrues to those contributions. And that there is no question in trust law about that. The trust applies both to the corpus, the original contributions, and any earnings on it. So as long as those earnings are used in some way to secure the benefits, ultimately, we're in good shape. But if we start using it to relieve employers of their first and final liability to make contributions that are necessary to fund the benefits, we are going to have a challenge. We think we will lose on that issue. So we're here to assist the committee with its policy objectives, but that's one which I think goes over the line, and we will lose on that objective if that becomes part of the law.
We certainly don't want that. I think hopefully you, Dave, we've given you some direction as to how we want this thing to look. The one question we haven't talked to, and I think that I know the answer already, but you know, currently in Tier 1, we've got the 8% guarantee. That's a floor. It has been suggested that we should say everything above 8% goes into the gain loss reserve or the contingency reserve. I believe that is not allowed. Am I correct?
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's been the position of the Department of Justice in a written opinion, which we've never recanted. I was involved with it. That the contract only guarantees 8%. If the policy was to give priority to the funding of the reserves as actuarially needed, if that was the legislative policy, we think that's a highly defensible position, even though the actual effect of that will be to reduce distribution of earnings to members, at least in some years. But to say money will go into the reserve irrespective of the need of that reserve, that's the problem. We can't get to that point.
Okay, so that's what we want to do. We got to get the actuarially sound, reserve, and we have to identify uses for it. We have to guarantee it's going to be funded up to an amount that is justifiable and we can defend, and that's what we want to do. Not much to do with the day. We got this bill scheduled for work session on Monday. Is that going to give you enough time? I'd like to be able to move from take some action on this bill on Monday. Tell me now if that's unrealistic.
Chair Barr, I would really prefer Wednesday. I got a lot of stuff in today for Monday. Even assuming I get it done on the weekend, our people in the back room trying to get that stuff done, all done for Monday, will be difficult. So Wednesday would be better for me.
I think I misspoke. I think I said we wanted it ready for Wednesday.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Mr. Muir and the Department of Justice have given us at PERS a letter dealing with many of the issues that that DOJ promised to treat with respect to the Dash 16 amendments and related issues. If the committee would like that opinion that was that letter opinion that was given to us, we'd be more than happy to share it with you, and it might assist the Legislative Council in their drafting.
Thank you. Please.
I have the changes proposed by the originators of the Dash 16. Have you seen those?
Yes, Mr. Putman. I've only had an hour to look at them.
So you got 45 minutes of sleep in there.
I would have.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We'll close the work session on the 134. And we've got a couple of House bills left on our agenda. And I was accused of not doing any House bills. See, Representative Patrick, I do House bills.
I have full confidence that the full progressive of the House will appear to be a majority of
the we will open a public hearing on House Bill 335. This one, 3358, you're here for?
Okay.
Mr. Putman, you guys want to come up while he presents the bill?
It's a straightforward bill, Mr. Chairman. It adds one representative and one senator to the Oregon Progress Board.
Here they are.
Sets their term as them appointed by the governor.
You will worry about the legislative member being authorized.
Well, I'll just stop there and see if...